Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
On the morning of March 18th, 1990, two thieves disguised as Boston police officers entered the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and stole 13 works of art.
They took a Vermeer and three works by Rembrandt, including Storm on the Sea of Galilee, the artist's only known seascape. The masterpieces are said to be worth $500 million. The Gardner heist remains one of the biggest art thefts in history.
And 25 years later, there have been many fizzled theories and false leads. But few people have followed the story as closely as Stephen Kirkchin. The Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and veteran of the Boston Globe has been on this story for nearly 20 years. And he's pieced together a deeper understanding of not just who might have stolen the paintings, but why.
Kirkchin writes about this in his new book, Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. When we talked with him, he began by telling us about one of the central characters in this story, South Boston's Louis Royce.
He truly was Boston's best thief for two reasons. One was he didn't drink, he didn't take drugs, he was always sober, and he was very patient. He would map out a score for hours or days on end to try to figure out how best to pull off a theft.
What kind of things was he stealing?
Most of it, he was a B&E, a breaking and entering artist, and that's what he did, through the 50s. He inured his way in to the underworld through types of scores like that. He usually was on his own, but later in life, in the late 70s, early 80s, he joined an underworld gang, the Rossetti Gang, and it was with those members of the gang that he saw and understood and learned the value of breaking into places where art was held.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about this, because in the book, you basically say that the idea...
It started with Louis.
...to rob the Gardner.
It started with Louis. The reason Louis found the Gardner Museum is because when he ran away from home, he didn't have a place to sleep at night. And he had, as a preteen, he had been brought to the Gardner by his public school as a class trip. And he loved the place. He loved art, but he also loved how warm it was. So when he ran away, he would sneak into the Gardner Museum before it closed and find places to sleep.
No kidding.
Now, this is an outrageous story to believe, but when Louis got out of jail in 2007 and I had already started to talk with him, I took him over to the museum. And as we were walking through, I said to him, Louis, show me where you slept.
Yeah.
He told me he slept up on the fourth floor. He would be awoken by two big clocks there. And he says, those clocks would drive me crazy, tick, tick, tick over the middle of the night. And then he would sneak out in the morning. He'd go into a bathroom and then open the doors for the days and then he'd sneak out.
I mean, Louis is really central to this story because, one thing that in the decades that this investigation has been going on that no one's really been able to clearly lay out until your book is, why?
Why would you do this?
Why would you? I mean, okay, there's the Thomas Crown, for lack of a better term, theory of some great art lover saying, I have to have that Rembrandt.
Right.
But the way they stole the paintings
that
makes it seem...
That.
Yeah,
that denies
they ripped them out of their frames.
Right. Pierce Brosnan is not the answer to this theft. These are the thugs who rob banks, rob armored cars, rob jewelry stores. They're always looking out for scores. And the FBI went to the museum and told the museum in, let's say, September 1981 that they had a problem. And the notes from that meeting that the FBI had with the museum were made available to me. And that shows Louis Royce, Ralph Rossetti were aiming towards breaking into the museum. They were interested in several paintings inside the blue room or the yellow room on the first floor of the museum.
So that was 1981, you're saying,
right?
I mean, but 9 years later, the theft happens anyway.
Yeah, right.
Why? Why did it happen in 1981?
Well, the motive became not because we couldn't get a piece of art for someone out there who may want a piece of art, but the true motive is to get a bad guy out of jail.
A bad guy out of jail.
It has long been a belief within the underworld that if you get your hands on a piece of art or a piece of stolen property, that the FBI or the authorities are so desperate to get back to their place, that they will let one of your associates out of jail.
So essentially what you're saying is that there was the idea to do an exchange, to steal stuff out of the garden in exchange for a criminal who's in jail?
Right, right. My reporting, I think, is good, but there's always a possibility. I don't have the paintings. I don't know where the paintings are, but I do think this account has validity because getting someone out of jail is an immense break for the bad guys. And if they could do it, they would do anything to get that art in their possession.
So how closely, if at all, does this theory map to what the FBI's theory is?
That I don't know. Unfortunately, the FBI last told the public what it knows or what it believes really in 2013, in which they said there was a network. Best I can figure out from what they're saying, it's a network that begins in a auto repair shop in Dorchester. That auto repair shop and those associates were part of the Salemi gang. The artwork was stolen. It was provided to an associate of that gang, a gentleman named Robert Garenti, and he held them up in his home residence in Maine for at least 10 years, 12 years. He got sick, and as his widow later told the FBI and the museum, he gave them to an individual in Connecticut. And the FBI is convinced that she's giving them an accurate account. And it led them to focus on that individual, try to get his cooperation. There was some cooperation at the outset. At some point, he got very scared, and he shut down.
Right.
And but the FBI went into his home, went into his backyard, and as my story says, went into a shed in his backyard where they absolutely believed the Rembrandt, Sea of Galilee, and the Vermeer, the concert, together worth $250, $300 million, that they rested, and they didn't find them.
You know, this story is so fascinating for so many reasons, including, like, all the false starts, all the speculations, all the supposed sightings of the the paintings, you know, the close call back in 97 with Herald reporter Tom Mashburg. But when we step back, I mean, you had mentioned the black market price of just two of the paintings at $300 million. And overall, I'm seeing that these are paintings that could be worth half $1 billion.
Right.
They are irreplaceable cultural treasures. Right. It's been a high-profile case. Why do you think that the FBI didn't really reach out to other law enforcement agencies, investigative authorities to help reclaim the paintings?
I think it's a bureaucratic and a cultural sovereignty that the FBI long has held. And for the most part, it works. But at some point, people started dying. People with knowledge or people with direct knowledge.
It had been so long.
It had been so long. And I think that's why there should be another approach now, which is an idea that I've wrote about in the Globe op-ed pages the other day.
We'll talk about that in just a second.
Sure,
but
fine.
I do want to ask you what you think this story says about Boston.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering, you know, this is a hypothetical. We can't know for sure. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, what if a similar theft on a similar scale had happened at the Guggenheim in New York or at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris or at the Wallace Collection in London? I mean, do you think that there's sort of a culture, an infrastructure or something that's different in those cities that maybe would have made people more motivated to get the artwork back? Or
My feeling as far as what this is unique about Boston is the tribalism. And that is intense. And I think that has factored into a code of silence. You know, you don't help out. Those aren't us. You know, we're whatever your high school is. We're old school. And that stopped an easy flow of a sense of, if I haven't lost something, I'm not going to get involved in the recovery. I'm not going to try to clean it up. Unless it hurts me and my family, I'm not going to raise my hand because it's going to get me in trouble.
Steve, you grew up in Dorchester.
Yes,
right?
I'm a Boston boy.
You feel the sense of loss from these paintings keenly.
You know, Boston is a wonderful city, but it can be a very tough city, especially in the years that I grew up. And I understood where Louis Royce, who grew up 10 years before me, the opportunities that I had, he didn't have. So he never had the opportunity to go straight, where there was no other, you know, there was no other course for me.
I'm very affected and taken by the fact that, you know, as you said, you went to Boston Latin, so right across the street, practically,
yes, right,
from the Gardner. I imagine you went there, you know,
well, my father
not
took
infrequently.
Me there. My father took me there. I was more a devotee of Fenway Park and right field yeah. than I was the Gardner Museum or the MFA. But my dad was an artist. He truly loved the old masters. As I got into it, I loved impressionists like everyone else, but he loved the masters.
But I guess I'm asking you as a Bostonian. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Storm on the Sea of Galilee is unique in the world, right?
Yes.
It's Rembrandt's only known seascape. But, you know, other than that kind of thing that art lovers and art historians might care about, as a Bostonian, why do you think it's important to try and find where these paintings are, to bring them back to the Gardner?
It's his only seascape, the greatest work from his early period. The Vermeer was the only Vermeer in New England. Go in front of the Boston Public Library onto the Dartmouth Street entrance, and you see two giant statues, one to scientific and one to artistic endeavor. Mm-hmm. There are eight names etched on that artistic endeavor. Six of those names have their artwork displayed at the Gardner Museum. So it's just that this is my city. This was taken from us, part of me. And we're a different city. We're a far different city than this place was in 1990. You know, in that sense of commitment of being together and talking about this loss may get the one person to call a reporter.
I think I know just the reporter that we'd hope they'd call. Well, Stephen Kirkjian is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of the new book, Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. It is quite a read. And Steve, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you heard how deeply Steve cares about this story, and he wants the rest of Boston to care as deeply, too, so he's got an idea. He wants to have Mayor Marty Walsh, Tom Brady, David Ortiz, and the like to stand in front of the empty frames in the Gardner and say, "These belong to our city. We need to get them back." Do you think that would raise the public's attention? Or do you have a better idea? Let us know on Twitter at Radio Boston.
Stay with us. Coming up, new science says when it comes to sex and desire, all women are different and all women are normal. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.